Okay, as it's almost 5 past, let me welcome all of you on this hot day, when just after a holiday when nobody really wants to work, but nice of you all to make time. I know there are a few more people are coming, as I said, but let's get on the way. Even those who don't follow Turkey, and everybody in this room does, are aware of the tensions. The last update, which is in front of you, which I think all of you who at least have seen, as I know I send it to almost everybody here, touched on this, is aware of what's going on, because they've read the Post and the New York Times, and of course they're also very much aware of the tensions with the military. Now, anyway, I'd like to welcome the new head of our European program, Julianne Smith. Thank you for joining us. I'm just saying that even those who don't follow Turkey are aware of the tensions, and they're aware of particularly the tensions between the military and the civilians. April 27th was the key date because of the statement that the military issued, and I thought we couldn't have a better person to look at the background to the current crisis. And to explain the relationship between the Turkish military, the Turkish General Staff, and the Turkish state, then Ersel Aydınlı. Some of you may be familiar with the article. It's almost like being back in Turkey. Really is. For those who haven't been, I swear, the Turks are the most... and Israelis, so I hear, yeah. Better uses of the telephones. Anyway, you might be familiar with the article he co-authored in Foreign Affairs, which looked at the TGS attitude, specifically with related to the Turkish EU process. Now, what I wanted him to do today was to, as I said, explain the background and then explain the relationship. His background, his own background, is as follows. As I said on the invitation, he's an associate professor and soon to be chair of international relations at Bilkent in Ankara. He was educated at Gazi University, got his MA in George Washington University, and after obtaining his PhD at McGill, did postdoctoral research at Harvard. He's taught at McGill, METU in Ankara, Middle East Technical University in Ankara, and George Washington University here in Washington before taking up his current position at Bilkent. I'd like to welcome you to CSIS. I'm really looking forward to your presentation. It is on the record unless you want us to go off the record.
It's okay. It's kind of
man. Okay.
First of all, I mean, thanks for inviting me in. It's nice to be back, kind of, in D.C. It was on the last September that me and my family, we decided to go back. And we think that we made a great decision. We are very much enjoying our life in Turkey and in Ankara, in Bilkent, in fact. We live in the campus, so we may not be living in Turkey, really.
campus.
Okay. You know, the... As someone, I mean, who used to work for the government or in the state, in the state security establishment particularly, it's the examining or studying the Turkish state or Turkish security establishment, even Turkish armed forces with respect to the society, has never been the primary kind of interest of mine. I am a scholar of international politics, political science, who am always concentrated on the international security affairs, but if you particularly kind of are sensitive to the Turkish politics as a Turkish first Turkish citizen, then Turkish intellectual, it's obviously impossible to not to study the Turkish state or the Turkish army in this case. So these are the views of a kind of former practitioner, later academic, who developed a later kind of interest in understanding the Turkish state. So some of these views may not really correspond to maybe the extremely pragmatic or practical, concrete things that you might be interested in knowing. But I will start with some general observations in which I think the current crisis or similar crises kind of unfold. And then maybe in Q&A section that we might get into more like concrete issues. Turkish nation and the Turkish society is a changing society. Whatever happens in the name of politics in my country, this is my understanding, is part of this major holistic transformation. Turkey is not the only country which is going through a transformation, rapid transformation. Particularly in Eurasia, there are countries going through with similar transformations. China is going one, Russia is going another one, Iran is going one too. These are all holistic kind of transformations in which not only the state structure, but the politics, the society, they all have to transform simultaneously at a rapid rate. And their armed forces obviously can't escape these rapid transformations. And most of the time, I'm going to get into that, but most of the time, these rapid transformations really provoke a high degree of national fear, that most people kind of fear of a total collapse. There comes in the role of the security establishment or the armed forces or the elements in a society that people generally expect the ultimate security once things really go back. So there is that connection in every society between a high degree of transformation, a resulting major fear, and also paying attention to the security provider, who, whatever that thing is. And Turkey is not a unique country in that sense. Several countries are going through these transformations, and they are interested in obviously some type of security in that sense. I just wanted to say right next to that a couple of words about the civil-military relations in general. You know, there aren't that many types, but there are four or five different paradigms. I mean, don't get kind of, you know, alarmed when I say paradigm. I'm not going to give a long kind of theoretical speech, but it might help us. We have the European one, European understanding of civil-military relations, absolute kind of isolation of the army, because there is a huge degree of fear about the militarism, and the army is seen as the basic tool for militarism, since the society and the nations are very afraid of that militarism. They really would like to keep the army out, completely subordinated and out. That's kind of the European paradigm as it is. There is the Latin American paradigm, in which basically everybody is afraid of the army because it's a predator institution. If it ever takes the power on, you know, you have to fight to get rid of them. They stay. In the history of them, we see the long-term kind of the military administrations. It's a very conflictual and confrontational one. There is the Soviet-style kind of the paradigm. These are perspectives rather than the paradigm, but the party owns everything else, everything basically in that country, including the army. So the army is the muscles of the party. Therefore, rather than the state, it's the loyalty, everything, the institutional and psychological connections is to the party. And there is the American paradigm, more or less. These are generalized kind of observations based on the professionalism, obviously, in which civilian control is unquestioned, but to a degree that the military experience, expertise, and vision sometimes don't even get listened to enough. You know, that the civilian kind of the perspective is really, really unquestioned, that even if you had 10 generals screaming there for something with even political implications, the civilians feel comfortable enough not to listen to them, and we saw it in the Iraqi case in terms of the numbers of even the troops. So there are these different kind of images or perspectives of the civil-military relations. The Turkish experience, of course, the Turkish doesn't seem to fit any of these either. It's not the army of the party, except between 1938 to 50. I think the army was the army of the single party. It's not a predator army in the sense that, for example, when it takes over, it doesn't like to stay there forever. One of the basic instincts it has that it wants to always, you know, bring the civilians back, take some measures in their mind, I'm referring to, and then kind of get back to their the barracks. Obviously, it's not the European style either, even though they would like to kind of let the civilians come back to power, they never really subordinate. And subordination, a complete and kind of a perfect subordination, is not in the dictionary of the kind of the Turkish army. So when we look at this, we realize that we are facing, first of all, at least a different type that seems to have some type of concordance of the civilian and the military rule together. So it requires kind of further understanding of it. When we look at further in depth, I think we realize that this Turkish style is shaped up by its historical experience. You know, throughout the Ottoman Empire, we were having a kind of talk during the lunch, we realized. Once they lost in Vienna, and the army was the first institution ever asked, why did this thing happen to us? And they immediately started the modernization. It was the first, again, institution for modernization because there was a problem. So the Cold War, the Liberation War particularly, was led by them. Cold War almost more or less was led by them. And modernization project, basically, which was entrusted completely in this institution. So the Turkish experience of civil-military relations, that concordance that I'm referring to, comes also out of this peculiar experience. This is not to just, you know, you might be getting into a feeling that, okay, now he's preparing us to basically say that our Turkish army has a unique nature and here is the reason. Now, it looks like in civil-military relations, when you look at the whole world, that there is not necessarily a universally accepted, really the standard of it. That is the background that I am trying to lay out here, that there are different images and perceptions of it, and Turkish, also the case, appears to be kind of representing its own type almost, a different type. So now, I think, kind of based on that background, I want to quickly say what Turkish army first. Basically, I try to tell you what Turkish army in that sense is not. Now, I want to say what it is, right? Obviously, it wasn't like a party army. It wasn't a Latin American army. So what is it then? I think it's an army with a strong internal indoctrination. This army is a very insulated and isolated one to a degree that, you know, it's so independent as much as possible from national and international popular ideas and views that this obviously does not mean that it doesn't ever adjust to the kind of changing views and the perceptions, but it builds up its own ranks in a manner that if they don't allow, no foreign idea can really penetrate easily into the ranks, the institutions, and the overall thinking of this institution. This does not mean, again, that they don't adjust. They do adjust. For example, the Kemalist ideology throughout the history within the army, we realize that it gets different tones. In the 70s, for example, it gets even more almost like left-wing, and then it gets more Turkish nationalist in certain decades. But only the leadership of the army makes these adjustments. It's not necessarily it comes, it penetrates from somewhere and then takes over. It's an extremely controlled and insulated institution. The other thing, Turkish army is not the army of an elite. I'll explain what I mean because several people think that they are somehow, you know, representing the elite and they are extremely connected to the elite. No, it's the army of the nation. It's the people's army. It's a conscript army. You know, all the Anatolian kids basically get recruited and they move up, they become the generals. But the interesting thing is that because of this previous point I made that this insulated, isolated nature, they produce their own elite. Those Anatolian kids, once they become the generals, because of all kinds of economic, political, and, you know, all kinds of privileges that they do produce, this institution does produce its own elite, but they're not necessarily representing the countries, the elite in the traditional sense that we are referring to. And then their families, then there's, I call them Anatolian kids and their families. They emerge into this unique new societal elite. It's in its own environment. The other thing, the Turkish army, is it's an institution with an extremely strong conviction that the defending the country goes beyond defending the borders. In fact, defending the borders is a small portion of the defending the country for this institution. It's defending the national identity, defending the regime, defending the national, in fact, even fabric. It's defending the, almost like the super, more like the superstructure of the society rather than the infrastructure. Infrastructure is easy in their mind. You can defend it. We have like 600,000, 700,000 soldiers. What's the point? We can always defend against, you know, Greece, Syria. Those are almost like given missions. But real challenge comes with this other definition in their mind that they have to defend the nation as it is and people as they are and governance system as it is. So that's, again, kind of a distinctive, I think, characteristic of them. But there is something interesting that I have to mention right there. Because they think that they have to defend this kind of social fabric, it's interesting that these kind of Anatolian kids, they emerge from those towns to the generalship and some type of eliteness. I think this kind of leads to a major disappointment in sometimes in their mind, when they don't see the same transformation taking place within the society. When they don't see that the normal also people kind of transform and become completely kind of changed and modernized, they get disappointed, forgetting one thing, that their own transformation takes place in this vacuum in an isolated environment, but the societal transformation has to take place in open air with all kinds of winds, influences, and ideas. But the reason, when you hear an argument a Turkish general or high-ranking person tells, we're not ready yet for full democracy, I think it's linked to this kind of interesting disappointment that they have in their mind, because they think that it's easy. I did it, so why don't they? But of course, their own really takes place outside of the society in a very carefully crafted kind of the mechanism. So then, I tried to kind of say what it is. There are other things, but I thought these were the important ones. Then what's the challenge for the Turkish army, right, at the start of the 21st century? I think the biggest challenge is that there is this widening gap between the traditional perception among the military leadership that the Turkish military is the ultimate guard of the status quo, and this sporadic and individual, I think, newly budding thinking that the Turkish army's historical mission is to guard the transformation and forward moving itself. The defining the status quo appears to be problematic in the minds. Some, a strong vein, I think, in the Turkish army thinks that what they have to protect is what is left from Atatürk as it is, without any change on it. But some others think that, no, and Özkök really represented, I think, this vein, thinking that, no, what we have to protect is the transformation itself, and it has to be forward-going because we have to provide security for the transformation. Our job is not necessarily to set blocks against the change, thinking that we have to protect the status quo, but we have to maybe open the path for further transformation, but take the security so that not only we as the guards kind of feel comfortable with it, but more importantly, the more the people, Turkish people, feel safe, they're going to be more aggressive in terms of transforming. I think that's that. I think if we were to locate a debate, kind of mindset-related debate within the Turkish army, this is the one that appears to be sometimes, you know, kind of resurfacing. But we read it different. We read it as if there are hardliners, softliners. We read it as if there are Democrat ones or coup lovers. But I think it's rather about the style, and it's rather about the speed of the transformation, whereas we have a group I'm kind of repeating this because I think it's important, because there are a lot of misperceptions on this issue. We have one group that thinks that, no, the status quo is basically what is right there as the principles of the Atatürk, principles of even the Republican regime, and one nation, no, in fact, multiple even ethnicities or ideas, and the Islam has to be exactly in a place where Atatürk left it. So that's one primary vein. And there is the other vein thinking that, no, what is left for us to protect is the safety of the transformation. This is why, for example, I drafted and the article in Foreign Affairs, because I sensed this when I did all kinds of interviews and conversations with the leaders of the army then too, that they really believed in the European Union direction then, at least 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and some wanted a much safer kind of journey to the European Union, and some said, look, maybe we can take some risks and open up further. But that small debate within the ranks appeared to be such a major divide for the societal observers. So there aren't that many people in this army which opposes to transformation at all. It would be self-denial. There are several reasons. It would be self-denial in terms of their long mission for as the guards of the modernization. And it will be also, it will be an institutional denial, but it will be also self-denial, because these people, with their families, their relatives, are the most revolutionized and most modernized segments of the society. When you go look at them, how they live, what they think, where they send their kids, and what they are kind of engaged in. So there are other reasons, but those would be too important. It would be, I think, in a sense, unimaginable for them to sit and say, no, we don't want, for example, the European Union. Because we would like to discuss the Turkish army with the names generally. So I should try to put some names in some context so that you can understand. For example, February 28 process, the Çevikbir type of kind of thinking represented this gradualist approach. No need to speed up. First, pay attention to what we have from the Atatürk's era. We can take our time because the society is not necessarily that ready. And Özkök type is a little bit different than that. No, that position is a problematic one, because once we take such a conservative position with respect to change, conservative elements within the society, also within the politics, do manipulate our position, and suddenly there is a setback against further revolutions in the country. So that was more or less, I think, the divide that that I could locate within the army. So it's the degree of the cautiousness. Of course, I'm not referring to really marginal points, particularly the retiring generals. Either they are upset because they didn't get a further position or something. They would just come up and tell you, oh, you know, what the heck with the European Union and all that. I think those are marginal and they shouldn't be counted in. The institutional understanding and positioning within this army is pro-change, but a safe change. One, for example, Hilmi Özkök, he was in Diyarbakır once when he was the chief of staff. I was there in the scene, that's why I was amazed. There were all these demonstrations, people are either saying the more human rights, economic things and all that, they were all complaining. I looked at them and, he said, look, this will all be over once we get into European Union. You won't have these complaints. I mean, this sounds too kind of rosy, I understand. But there is this understanding that that type of membership, the road to that, is going to solve several major problems that the Turkish government and the army are facing. I would even go further and make an argument that this institution, I believe, even thought, maybe not at this moment, but up until 2-3 years ago, that, for example, the Kurdish separatism, Islamism, particularly the economic problem, and some even international problems of Turkey were going to be resolved much easier within a European context than by itself. Turkish army as an institution and the generals are smart enough, I think, to learn one thing, that the Turkey by itself, Turkish politics, can't really solve some of these chronic issues. You can't just sit down and solve, for example, Kurdish separatism by yourself. In Islamism even, right? An economic problem, definitely so. So I think there is some also cost-benefit analysis in that sense, some rational choice-making. Of course, most of the kind of observers follow the Turkish army and Turkish state by these kind of radical statements most of the time, that this kind of the voice of dissent, in a sense. So it might appear at odds. My words in here might appear at odds with those, but I really think that when you listen to, for example, most of the retired chief of staff, retired high-ranking generals in their home, when you ask them in a relaxed environment about these issues, European Union, modernization issue, how we could deal with these problems, you get results more consistent with the lines that I am trying to present in here. So then it looks like the primary challenge for the Turkish army is to kind of transform from this rather conservative, arguably overcautious, gradualist approach to the more proactive, forward-thinking one. That appears to be the challenge. Then how is this then transformation going to take place? I think there are three responsibilities, and everybody has a share for it. The first responsibility goes to the civilian politicians in Turkey, I think. They have to acknowledge that we have an army which is transforming in mindset, which is transforming, but they have to help this transformation rather than provoke it. I mean, it's not only the politicians that I'm going to talk here. So I have also suggestions for the army, but this is the first set. The politicians, I think, have to be extremely careful that there are certain sensitivities and there are certain issues that if they ever, for example, plunge in those issues out of the electoral, for example, concerns, they are really, I think, creating a major setback for this transformation or within this critical institution. And that's a pity. And I should give you one, maybe that would bring it to today's politics, an example. That, for example, these Republican meetings, demonstrations and all that. Of course, everybody reads it differently. But when I look at the politicians, and even the government, but they seem to read it as if there is a one-third kind of this aggressive Turks, right? They are really aggressive in every sense, that they want, or one-third or one-fourth, depends on, you know, the day. Sometimes they kind of see it 25%, sometimes they see it one-third. And then they see the other two-thirds like as if either religious, Democrat, anti-coup, anti-military, even anti-all this aggressiveness. It's for which, at the end of the day, sometimes leads them to take certain positions, act almost like cocky, and say that I have the majority, so sorry for you, kind of. Which is not a great way of looking at it. Why? We look at all kinds of countries. One-third is a major kind of proportion of the society, and most of the time in several countries, this one-third, particularly a revolutionized one-third, and in the Turkish case, this one-third is the one which transformed itself first, therefore has the most to lose, therefore ready to do anything. So the weight of one-third is much bigger than really the arithmetical or mathematical one-third. Sometimes politicians don't understand that, and then they go by the numbers only, and that appears to be provoking also institutional responses. That's what I mean when I say that politicians have to be much more careful in reading the real weights of sometimes real segments of the society. This wouldn't mean, of course, that they should quickly ignore the two-thirds, but they shouldn't forget there is also the one-third. I think the second responsibility, I'm trying to cut it a little shorter so we could have the Q&A larger. The second responsibility goes to the foreign elements, such as the European Union and the United States. I think, unfortunately, European Union particularly, they must sit down and make their mind very quickly. They have been so wishy-washy that really is not helping at all. Neither the one-third demonstrating in the streets, nor the two-thirds like now puzzled, but they are trying to remain democratic and kind of conservative. Neither the politicians in Turkey, nor the army. The European attitude has been extremely damaging. Not with the army's position, but with the society's overall kind of the standing. And I am, in fact, I feel extremely sad because I realize I was in London kind of listening. We were there together even. Uh-huh. And it is sad that, you know, now they are really happy that there is this thing, almost they're doing this ghost politics now. They're like, I am sorry, you know, you couldn't do enough because there is Turkish army. There is Turkish deep state. There is this ghost politics now that everybody is putting the blame on something which is not very well even defined yet. No one knows what the Turkish army is or wants, but everybody says they are refraining you, aren't they? And those who have failed in performing better, they are also nicely saying, yes, something is really refraining us. I can't tell you what it is. You know what it is. And it's a strange type of ghost politics, but it's I think, a coalition kind of is emerging out of convenience that there are so many who have problem with the further transformations and all that. They are nicely pointing at this dark spot, which is not defined at all. So that's, I think, that's a major problem. And European Union, this current kind of attitude, if it continues, it's not going to help again this transformation that I was referring to within the ranks or within the leadership of the Turkish army. Because at the end of the day, Turkish, I think, army is thinking only one thing. Can we remain intact once we are out of this tunnel? It's a transformation tunnel. Can we remain intact? Politicians don't ask that question, really. Politicians say, okay, am I popular or not? Are European, pro-European policies popular now? Then I'm going to be pro-European. I don't care really if something happens in 2 years and then suddenly, for example, the degree of separatist understanding in this country skyrockets. But the Turkish state has to sit down and think about that because they think that, gosh, these politicians are out, but the problems will remain the same. And people will expect me, I'm going to get into the people's dimension now, to even deal with it. There is some, you know, kind of inherent, original, genuine differences in their position with respect to this. The final responsibility, I think, goes to the army itself. In order to kind of keep this transformation, you know, alive in their mind. The army leadership, I think, has to pay more attention to this emerging new way of thinking that highlighted by the Özgök era, that Turkish society, I believe, has always wanted progressive changes. You know what? It's easy to criticize Turkey, but I am a comparativist, for example. I do always try to compare with the other countries. You realize how much Turks have transformed and how much they love transforming and how much they love change, in fact. So they want change, they want transformation, they want democracy. You know what? They want only one more thing. They want democracy, but they want a guard for the democratization. This is what they want. That's why, you know, you might get puzzled when you think that, oh my God, this army always intervenes, but it's still the most popular institution in Turkey. How come? The explanation lies in the mindset. The Turks want more change, but change means chaos. In a geography, also a country that the change always brought in chaotic kind of outcomes. So they want a guard for that transformation because they don't think that the politicians can take that responsibility. Guarding the change, they would like to keep their army somewhere there just in case something happens, so that someone would take the safety of the transformation, which I call reform security. that they want to have someone to provide that reform security. That's why when you hear those slogans in those meetings, when they say, neither Sharia nor coup, it has got nothing to do with either Sharia or coup. When they say, neither Sharia, they say, look, Sharia won't come. They don't believe in that problem. But they think that the change can only be provided by the politicians. They believe in the government, but they also think that safety can't be provided by the government. They want also the army without making the coup. It's extremely simple to me. I also looked at the surveys. I attended many of those. They are very pragmatic. This nation has been coming from a history that changes always took place. But there was one basic instinct, never change. Do you remain intact out of this tumultuous period? And for that, you need to have a security provider, just in case something goes bad. I'll give you one specific example. For example, nowadays, just after this last intervention kind of attempt, or I don't know how to call it still, of course, now the conservative circles, they present themselves more like a democratic, you know, we need to really stick to democracy. It's really against democracy that there is this intervention, which is totally understandable. When you, for example, do survey the same type of people, and when you ask them this question, when you say, look, the separatist, for example, challenge in this country is really heightening. And, for example, some people call it mini or almost like rebellion. Some people, this should be off the record, I think, this mini rebellion thing. But the separatist challenge is really serious. There are, for example, Mersin, there are certain towns, the Kurdish town, Kurdish districts, Turkish districts are separating, which is unheard in the Turkish history in the past. So what would you do if really such a challenge becomes really the kind of national threatening? These democratic circles all point at the Turkish army, you know. They say, there is the army. They would come and take care of it. People have intrinsic fears with respect to each other. Islamists have it with the Kurdish separatists. Kurdish separatists have it with the Turkish separatists. Alevites have it with the Sunnis. Sunnis have it with the Alevites. When there are these fears, they have someone in their mind that they think if things go bad, that one is going to come at least stop those people, prevent those people from taking over. I think that's why they want to change, the Turkish people, but they want a guard for it. They want a democracy, but they want a guard for the democratization. And it's not unique to Turkish kind of context. For example, China has a model of transformation too. Let it go all the way to the moon in the economic realm, but keep the political, for example, party intact. If someone acts funny, shoot them, basically. So it's a safe transformation. Russia was going through a very tumultuous one with the Yeltsin era. They realized that it was becoming too chaotic. They brought Putin in now as the image of the security and stability provider. This is the problem for all the countries which are going through tumultuous transformations. And Turkish people, I think, are aware of it. That's why I don't think there is a Turkish inner state, but there is a Turkish inner nation. And that one-third is marching here and there to protest something. I think they are the ones who want safety for the transformation. That's why I think the role of the armed forces in their mind comes in. So, if you ask then the natural question now, so is there going to be a coup? The possibility of a coup, this is my understanding out of this analysis, in Turkey will last forever. Even if we become, but I'll explain what I mean, even if we become the member of European Union one day, as long as this fear within the Turkish society remains intact, as long as we think that, you know, there are still possibilities for some marginal ideas or groups to take over, we will always would like to, we will always want to have a kind of security provider or guarantor somewhere there. So you will always hear the possibility of an intervention or possibility of someone to stop the marginals here and there. But the good news is, Either, that's why I always believed in the European kind of EU track. The good news is if we stick to that track, and if one day become the member, that's great, because this guarding mission for the change or the transformation is going to be taken over by the European institutions, and Turks are going to say, great, now I don't have to have these soldiers here to watch me, because just like any other European people, European institutions are going to take care of it. For example, European Court is not going to allow the Hatzikarfting, great, or this and that, economic level, so that the guard is going to change, not the mission. I think as long as this fear is going to be always there, we only have one option. We can change the guard. As long as we can't change the guard is going to remain there. Or if we don't become the member, along the way, I think, because of all those reforms and etc., we're going to build up further muscles over our democratic institutions so that one day this also protection feeling is going to be provided by our own democratic institutions. Then we, again, may not need the Turkish army for that particular, I think, role. Then the last word should be, I think, this. If you want to understand, I think, the potential of Turkish army's intervening capacity, it's not the army that you should really necessarily focus on. It's the Turkish nation and the society that you need to look at. And it's the particular connection between the Turkish society and the Turkish army. I think the Turkish nation, because of its intrinsic fears, fragmented nature and all that, really using its armed forces for this particular mission to feel safer because they think they are going through a tumultuous period. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What a fascinating presentation. You know, usually I would have formed the first question I traditionally ask by the time you get halfway through your through the presentation. But in this case, I have so many questions to ask, which I'm... Can you turn yours off? Otherwise, we're going to get an echo. I'll leave it to the distinguished members of the audience to pick up. But I want to pick up on something that you said, at least one of the many things that I would love to pick up on. I just want to pick up on one of them. You kept on going back to this inner fear. Another word for it is paranoia. Clearly, there is paranoia in the Turkish society, sometimes called the Sev syndrome, for want of a better expression, that, you know, the Europeans, the Westerners, the non-Turks are out to divide us. Now, you talked about how the nation looks to the army to have this guided transformation. It's almost like the training wheels that a child has. You know, at some stage, you take the training wheels off. To what extent is there them looking over their shoulder to see their father holding them on this bicycle due to the fact that the military has intervened so many times in the past? So there is a tradition of either them stumbling or stumbling over something that has been put in their path, and then the military then comes to rescue them. Now, to me, it seems like the chicken and egg situation, and certainly, yeah, I mean, you talked about good intentions on the part of everybody, but, you know, let's not assume good intentions. There are some people, civilians and military, who have abused this symbiotic relationship between, you know, the nation looking to the military to save them and the military doing it only when they feel that they have to for their own ends. Now, clearly, we're in one of those impasses now. Now, you did not focus on the current situation, but do focus a little bit on this situation. Now, you talked about the ever-present possibility of a coup. Here we are talking seriously about a coup 10 years after the last time that there was a stumble. And it is very much tied, and I won't get into this because I think other people will pick it up, that it's very much tied to the EU process running into an impasse because, you know, the change in the civilian-military relationship was due to a great extent to the EU process, and that's come to an end. How can you get out of the current impasse if the background is as complicated, or complex is a better word, as you made it clearly made it out to be.
I think you are definitely right in one thing, that this symbiotic relationship between the Turkish nation and its army doesn't work always, you know, in an excellent manner, which is very normal. Take February 28 process. There are credible arguments now that I am even, like, considering writing an article on it, that it was largely a civilian coup. When you look at it, that some generals got carried away, basically, either for personal kind of expectations. One wanted to be the president, for example, out of that chaotic environment. And you can see that several of the civilians, they saw an opportunity to get rid of their arch rivals.
And they could not do themselves.
Yes. So it's open to manipulation. But I was trying to kind of, first of all, provide a, you know, much, it's more like a background of the relationship. But it, and now, one might even again might make an argument saying that basically, it gets manipulated again. Why? Because it becomes part of the politics. That's why I think that the Turkish army has to rethink again what exactly their mission is. Their mission is to guard the transformation. Their mission is not to create set blocks against the change. There is a major difference if they were to sit down and think about it. Here is the one advantageous thing. If they were to sit and say, look, my mission is to guard the transformation, which puts me outside of the politics. Therefore, no one can call for a coup saying that it's my job. Right? That would give even an opportunity for them not to be manipulated. But the moment they appear like they are defending the status quo, then they are becoming part of the daily politics. And then the manipulation potential then rockets up.
Okay.
And everybody does that.
Yeah. Okay. Before I open up to the floor, I've got to pick up on this very briefly. Yeah. See, it all then turns on the definition of transformation. Mm-hmm. Okay, if the military takes it upon itself to define what kind of transformation it accepts, okay, then we have a serious problem when you have the will of the people expressed through elections and you have a government that believes that it is actually the product of and the leader of the transformation, and a military that says, no, transformation thus far is okay, but beyond that is not okay, and that is precisely the kind of problem that we have today.
Look, that's really, I think, this where we are now is really a great place to make a couple of observations. This understanding that the Turkish army, for example, imposed its own version of transformation might have been valid in the past, but is not anymore. I'll give an example. Right after, I think, Helsinki, right, 99, there was, and we wrote this in the article too, you can see, even we knew even the internal dynamics of them, but we couldn't point at. There was a national consensus between the army and the leading, for example, civilians, the politicians, and they sit and they said, look, the goal, end goal is European Union. There was no question about it. The army was not saying that this is my type of transformation. The civilian leadership and the army sat together and they said, here is the goal. That consensus, in fact, led to a lot of revolutionary changes. Look, when, for example, changes in National Security Council were pushed, the army said, please, help yourself. Do it overnight, the way you want. All kinds of revolutionary changes even affected the internal dynamics of the army. The army did not necessarily say no. Do you remember the coalition government and how even a coalition government was able to make really revolutionary moves? That would have been impossible if the Turkish army did not really give the green light. It wasn't against the Turkish army. It was with the Turkish army. Here is what I'm trying to say. That consensus
has broken down.
Has broken down. So that's the problem. Why? I think this current government was doing pretty good at the beginning because they came at a time that the consensus was already built up between the civilian leaders and the army, and they said they would play along, and they did. That's why they were able to not only remain like unquestioned power The military never said, oh, these are Islamists, I don't want them. They didn't at the beginning. And again, they agreed with all kinds of revolutionary changes in the Özgürlük era for the EU things. But when the government slowed down with respect to EU, when this external kind of system...
All right. I'll let you go. But
all right. Okay. All right. This is not to blame it on the government, but I'm trying to identify how that consensus somehow has broken down. So something happened to that consensus, and suddenly the identity of the government, which was always there and never created a problem for the security establishment, became a problematic spot. In fact, they said it was a subtlety. As long as you remain on this path, and they said, yes, we will, because our predecessors, right, the civilians, agreed to this. As long as you remain, you can be an Islamist. But once that overall direction, something happened to that overall direction, then we started to talk about all these little issues. Your identity, your hidden agenda, my hidden agenda. I think that's why... Here is what I want to say. That's why I don't think that the Turkish army is really imposing. I mean, is European Union goal an imposition of anything? Turkish people want it, civilians want it, and the army want it. So you should stick to it. If you don't stick to it for political reasons or other reasons, then there is a problem with that directional kind of orientation. Once there is a problem with that directional orientation, see, then everybody goes back to those inner fears. And suddenly they start calling names for each other. You are that. I am this. And then what am I going to do with the separatist challenge, and etc. We went back to normality, which is chaotic and ugly, in fact, for our country.
I'm sure a lot more people have the kind of questions I have in mind, so I will forego those. Start with Steve, and then you ask him each other.
I'm not convinced by your analysis, and in the sense that I think the driving force in all of this is not necessarily the EU process, although it obviously plays an important role. It seems to me, quite frankly, that and I will disagree with you, I think there was a concern from the beginning when the hack came in. And you can see it around the March 1st vote and how the army played that vote and so forth. And there's been a degree of mistrust on the part of the army from the very beginning. And it's intensified. What seems to me brought this crisis to a head was the fact that you were going to have an Islamist president, which you had never had before, and that you would have had all three parts of the political spectrum, that is the government, the head of the parliament, and the president in the hands of the AK Party. And that gave a lot of people pause. They could accept the fact that the AK had, the Islamists had a lot of power, as long as there was at least one institution, with the presidency, which remained in the hands of the secularists, and of course, obviously, the army itself. But I would argue that it was much more this fear that, you know, we are taking a real leap now into the unknown. We, you know, there's no going back. This reminds me to a certain extent of the question of the Euro communists and so forth, whether you can kind of trust them and once they get in power and this sort of thing. So, yes, the EU played an important role, but after all, the AK itself also has moved back a little bit and retreated on the EU. But it seems to me it's this other institutional issue which really has provoked the crisis.
Look, you know, the presidential pick or who was going to be the president obviously was an extremely important thing. But the consensus, the general consensus that I refer to, that which was there once this government came to the power, that it was the state's policy and it was decided in National Security Council between the army, the civilians, the president of then the coalition governments was also there. And this government came in and they played along. That consensus tradition, which was done for the EU, gave an opportunity for everybody to overcome this mistrust as much as possible. It was a platform, and the soldiers were probably thinking that, look, there won't be any difference. The previous politicians were also working to this end. These current ones are also going to work to this end. So why should I? Why should I create a problem? Because February 28 process damaged Turkish army's certain image. I mean, do you think that they were extremely happy with what happened in February 28? Several of the people who were actively part of it, they were removed from their past posts within this army, but they did it very quietly. This army is very interested in its institutional prestige and the image, and they never want to appear at odds with the nation that is conservative even. But that consensus that I was referring to it's not just about the European Union goal, but it was the first time this naturally mistrusting entities had a way of working, and they were saying, okay, there is an IMF economic program and there is an EU political program that everybody is at peace with. And this government basically followed that. And the current even chief of staff would basically stay and wait. Of course, this crisis was kind of upcoming, the presidential thing. But I still think that if that consensus, this is complete prediction, I might be off. If this consensus that I refer to was in its place, I think the government would have first of all picked someone else as part of that consensus building understanding. And we would not have had this crisis. And if that consensus was again in its place, that European orientation, then the army would have been much less reactionary to whatever this government was doing. That's what I am saying.
You came close to this when there was this bargaining going on around the presidency. There seemed to have been, from what I can gather, a consensus that it would not be you, and it would not be Erdogan.
Yes.
But it would be the defense minister.
Yeah. And that was okay.
The military could live with that.
Of course.
What changed that, it seemed to me, and this is the role I think that Arendt played, was when he said, it has to be one of us. One of us.
He said also, it has to be a religious one. Right. In quote,
And that, therefore, and he said, if you won't run,
see, but that's,
and Gould is not. And that would have been
See, but that tipped off that trust, the minimal degree of trust that I am referring to, that was there before. So that's why it is important. What would you think if you were the Turkish army leadership and building up this image that your counterparts are slowly telling you that, look, don't worry, you know, more or less. We'll get someone that will be okay to everybody. And then overnight, they announce a different name. And in a country that people are demonstrating here and there, one-third, and basically chanting and saying, no, we don't want that, we don't want this. As an institution, you also think that. See, this is not my analysis, but I'm trying to put myself in their shoes, that you want to always lead that nation. You don't want to be left behind. You don't want suddenly 50% of the society marching for something and you haven't even said a word for it. At the end, this institution also acts like a political party. They want to be popular. They want to be in line with their nation and the society. That's why that consensus, that's not the tipping point, but that consensus was broken down once this government, I think, slowed down on two things. Slowed down. It wasn't their fault. It was largely the EU fault, but they slowed down with the EU process. The second thing was this government, still to me, I don't understand the reasons, they've been extremely reluctant with respect to the Kurdish separatist challenge. And that was, I think,
the Kurdish,
Kurdish separatist challenge.
We can explain that. But go ahead.
Okay. I mean, you should come and explain that. I would be happy
to get into it. Because, in fact, the EU process partly slowed down. Forgive me for jumping
no,
in.
No, I was referring to you should go to Turkey and explain it there.
It slowed down partly because they were worried about the military reaction, not just on the Cyprus issue, which, remember, almost caused two coups, but also on the Kurdish issue and ultimately on the fundamental change of civilian-military relations, which the EU demanded. I mean, we cannot get away from that as we look at the performance of the government.
I think, you know what, I think with this analysis, we might be falling into that traditional trap. I think the government was less interested in these fears were there, but they were less and less interested in European Union direction because European Union direction thing was becoming less and less popular within the society, and it was becoming less and less popular in terms of political projections. That people were starting to think that Europeans will never accept us anyway. See, there were all these factors. That's why I call it ghost politics, because that's the easy one. People immediately understand, the Europeans tell us it's the army. We tell them it's the army anyway. No one asks the army whether it's the army or not.
And eventually ghosts come through the door.
Kind of.
Yasemin Chongar and then Ambassador Paris.
First of all, thank you very much for very interesting observations. Two points, or rather two questions. The first is, if I can fool you a little bit toward more specific issues. The April 27th declaration, where does that sit in terms of the internal dynamics of the army you described? You described two groups. One is more for guarding the transformation of Yugo, and the other is more for the status quo. So who did it in those terms? I'm also asking this because I was recently in Turkey. Everybody's talking about it. The almost incoherent language of the statement, the very casual style of writing, the way it was done almost in a haphazard kind of manner, I think has led many in Ankara and even in Washington to think that maybe this was not done according to the hierarchical chain of command and it was perhaps imposed on the top brass. Do you have such a sense? And secondly, to pick up where Bülent touched on the two coups in the making in 2003, if we accept your point that the slowing down of the government on the EU process, which I agree was a factor in everything we have been living through, but if we accept it as the main reason or the main explanation for what happened, how can we understand then what happened in 2003, 2004, when everything seems to be going at full speed toward the EU, and there was the Annan plan, and there were hopes for Cyprus.
And 70% support.
Yes, and Bülent also mentioned it in his recent analysis. So the two coups or plans for coups with codenames Moonlight and what was it, Blonde Girl, and they were in the making by a certain group, it looks like, if the reports are correct, a certain group within the military were about to stage a coup. So how do you look at that? Is there a junta within the military?
This is obviously the most difficult thing to ever know. We can't. I mean, as long as they don't tell us, and they would never tell you. But I feel like only comment in a general sense, but which might lead some kind of light on that darkness, I think. First of all, the current chief of staff, I think, is enjoying one of the highest controlling prestige capacity in the Turkish army. There's no question about it. Everybody says that, so it must be right. I mean, this young officers thing, that always people say, oh, the young officers think this way, therefore all these kind of act alone. There is no such a thing in Turkish army. Turkish army had that problem in 1960s, 50s, and they hanged one of the colonels, Talat Aydemir, who, there was an era in this Turkish army's history that, the younger generations and mavericks, they kind of got up one morning, they organized and they said, okay, I'm going to go take over because these old ones are too pro-establishment. There was an era. There were back-to-back a lot of attempts, but Turkish army solved that problem, saw the problem really and solve that problem, particularly within after 1980, not only with the Constitution, but they made a lot of internal changes. And since then, there is no hierarchy problem in this army, I believe. There is no hierarchy problem. The chief of staff of this problem, the army, obviously, generally enjoys a huge degree of control. And this army has built up over the years, I think, institution, ways and mechanisms to even further strengthen this system, that you don't get mavericks. You can only get people, I think, some or generals from the top 15, right? Because they are, some of them, there's no further room to go, and they're like, they want to prove themselves, maybe. They had aspirations, they could never become the chief of staff and all that. That's why you get all those, the statements. So there might be room for such you know, the stuff that you are referring to, the diaries and all that. That's why I can't know.
Young officers.
But young officers, there is no young officers thing. There is no young officers because the promotion system is so cruel within the Turkish army that no young officer has any prospect at all if you don't really obey. You know, then you're not a young officer. You're not an officer. If you have such a... There used to be that problem, but this... Look, one other thing maybe which might be related to this. There is one other thing that Turkish army is more afraid of than something happening to Turkish society and the Turkish
public. Happening to itself.
Yes, but you know why? Because they think that, you know, they can't even come back and save the country from the ruins. But for that, they have to remain intact. That's why they took the first measures, 70s, 80s, to fix their mechanism so that there wouldn't be these kind of mavericks. So it's extremely hierarchical and institutionalized. And Büyükhanıt is even a peculiar kind of, I think, chief of staff that has ultimate control. Özkök, maybe we could not have said the same thing for Özkök in that sense. Some young officer thinking, maybe, I don't think, but would have been there. But for the current one, I don't think so. In terms of the statement, I agree with you. I mean, I read it a few times too, and I stopped reading it. But you know what? It looked like I was just grading my master's students' papers before I came in. I tell them, look, this is no good. Go fix it again. And then he goes and then comes back. 10 times later, it becomes something illegible. I can't even understand because he gets afraid. It changes. Probably something like that happened. I understand that, which is true probably. That it's been always, there has been a draft like that. But they never let it out. My overall understanding is that they felt they got cheated. And then they just put it that night. They felt like they got cheated because they felt like someone did really something tricky at the last moment. Someone did not really do what they promised.
Yeah, I actually put that into the report too, that Büyükhanıt may have been told by Erdogan that it was going to be Gönül. So the rumor mill goes, and then he was shocked.
Probably,
to go
yeah.
back on what you were saying. And by the way, I can't resist the temptation to explain a little bit of what, to expand on something that he just said. One of his colleagues, a nationalist colleagues at Bilkent that I won't name, was reported, please don't, was reported or rumored to have been the author of this.
We write articles, he writes so much stuff.
Exactly, exactly. Ambassador.
But Thomas. No, but he said he didn't.
He said
he didn't. Well, I don't know, he says he didn't.
Well, the question is who corrected it.
But I think, you know, it's a typical thing. It goes to a kurmay and then comes back. And then, you know, there's a red pen. You know, it's always you kind of fix and then it goes back again. And it might be even cut and paste from the earlier speeches. It's there are all kinds of issues. I don't know.
I want to take this to the theoretical level.
Okay.
Because this was a heavily theoretical analysis you gave us, and I liked it very much.
Okay.
Your point about the Turkish military working to an original paradigm, not like the American, not like the Russian, etc. Mm-hmm. the most trenchant element of which I take by implication to be a desire, as you put it, at the end of the tunnel to be intact.
Yeah.
We talked about this again a minute ago, that at the end of the day, it's very important that they be around because they be the only thing between the nation and chaos. But there's a conundrum here, it seems to me, because if the agreed agenda is the European Union, and that's what's kept these disparate parties together.
That's probably also my wishful thinking. I see it as the only kind of possibility. You know, there's half-half probably.
But let's assume that that's the case and that this was an agreed agenda on which they were all able to work. Your European paradigm is subservient military.
Yeah.
No two ways about it.
Yes.
They are secondary players, and they're going to stay secondary players. And there's no coming back at the end of the day, whether they're intact or not. So it raises the question of whether there's not, at the very core of the Turkish military's self-image, the paradigm by which they work, an internal contradiction which makes this whole thing unworkable at some level. And you may be able to patch it together in pursuit of something like the EU project for a while, but if it reaches the point where this might actually be happening, doesn't it create an imperative to break out to ensure that you're intact at the end of the day?
No, you're definitely right. But here is the thing. Technically, when we wrote this article with my colleagues, the previous article, that was this last paragraph, I don't remember, but I think this army thinks that once they dock this ship safely, I think they would throw their own friends off the deck to the sea. This should be off the record, probably. I don't think. That's my own understanding. Kind of. But I think they would. But it's the feeling that, okay, this is finally safely docked in here. And I remember in my interviews years ago, I was doing it, and someone said, look, I would like to be a European general. I would get better paid. My kids do better. I already live like a European. Why not? Seriously, why not? I mean, would you like to be in the Turkish army's position? Would you like to, for example, think about it all the time? The separatist challenge there, Islamist challenge here, an economy that you have no idea to deal with. Would you like to be? Why? That's why it differs from the Latin American paradigm. It's not it's not an army to take it over and then remain there, because it's not an individualistic army. This is an institutional army.
Well, I'm with you up to the point where they walk off the plank and leave the ship at sea. But it's hard for me to conclude, even based on your analysis, that that's what is actually going to happen.
I think that's the challenge. Yeah. Because if Europeans, for example, don't act properly, in code, suddenly people start thinking that, see, they will never admit us. Therefore, we have to always remain intact, but maybe further underground. So we're going to see less and less visibility of the Turkish army. But Turkish people, that's the thing. I don't think we should think about Turkish army. What about the need of the Turkish nation? Turkish nation still would like to think, even if we are in there, I still would like to know that someone should help me. But it doesn't fit the paradigm, I understand. That's the thing.
It doesn't even fit the discussion. You can't have a discussion of a country becoming a member of the European Union in the same discussion as you're talking about the possibility of military coup.
I think here is what we're trying to say. I think this is what I'm saying. This is the most, I think, the controversial fine part of the overall argument. Once it has become full member of it, this army is ready to dissolve itself, as it is. See, because when you talk to them, you would get that understanding. That's why I don't want people to immediately think that this army is anti-EU, because they never want to resolve their problem. Once they become full member, if we were the full member, but they start thinking that we will never become a full member, and therefore, why should we dissolve the ultimate guarantee of the change? That is a dilemma, we don't have an answer to it. That's a dilemma. It's a timing issue, and it's an other type of problem that no one can know now. How could we know? The only thing I know that if there was a better process, this army would play along with it.
I was going to jump in, but I know Hillel wants to pick it up.
More quick, as I think that maybe they think that the maybe there's a misunderstanding. Maybe they think the EU is as serious about democracy as NATO is. But anyway, but and let me just make a comment, and please don't answer until you get to your other question, which were ahead of me. But I mean, I think we led that at various times, if you'll forgive me for talking about a conversation we've had. I think we can look at the actions of the Turkish army in the last couple of years and say these are all designed, or substantially designed, to stop Turkey from coming into the EU. Period. That's kind of, if I look at all of the things that the army has done,
as Hilal has referred to conversations with me, let me just clarify. Now, there was ultimately...
It was things I was saying.
I'm happy to pick it up. Now, there was always a question in my mind whether the Turkish army had, and, having read your article, I still remain unconvinced, had crossed the line where it accepted transformation into the European model in which it would be subservient to the civilians. Look, Donatella is working with us at the moment. She's sitting at the other end of the table. She's Italian. Italy is in the EU. I asked her who the Italian chief of staff was. She did not know. Now, is Turkey ever going to get to the point where Turks don't know who their chief of staff is? And by extension, what the role of the Turkish military in Turkish society is not what it is today, and it's more akin to what of the Italian army within Italian society. I didn't think that the Turkish military had made that decision irrevocably in its own mind. Now, combined with the hostility within the EU to Turkish membership, we have now entered a situation in which maybe a self-fulfilling prophecy is maintaining or helping to maintain or perpetuate the Turkish military position. I mean, that's my skeptical view all along of the process, and I'm afraid that the current crisis is a product of the EU impasse, which maybe everybody, wearing uniforms and otherwise, had foreseen all along.
Can I jump in there?
Please.
Because it's very interesting. I'm sure there might be people here, actually, who know much more about the European Union internal dynamics than I would. But, even though there is a European paradigm, the European countries do not enjoy same type of civil-military relations patterns. In Finland, everybody knows the name of the chief of staff. Finland is a part of the country. In Spain, here and there, I understand when you say, look, there has to be a European standard, obviously there is, but it's not extremely homogenous as you think it is. So we don't know what type of Turkey we will have once it's ready for the full membership. In that Turkey, the civil-military relations, the nature of the civil-military relations in Turkey might be at a degree that Turkey also would take its place in Europe, with a different image of civil military.
Yeah, but you said that there might, but with the possibility of mounting a coup even within the EU.
Yes. Well, but remember,
doesn't fit into any kind of model.
But I'll say that. Here is the thing, because I still say it, because I think that it's not the army's position, but as long as the need that the Turkish nation, I'm referring to all kinds of fears and the societal fragmentation, as long as that fear is there, then the Turkish nation is going to expect some guardianship from an institution. See, I am not looking at the army. I am looking at the origins of this need within the society. And if that continues up until we are the member of the European Union, my logical conclusion is what? Then the possibility of an intervention is going to be there. I'm not looking at the army because it's a dead end. You can look at today's chief of staff and say, oh, it's great. I don't know, because we can't even read the mindset. Probably they would tell you, this is going to sound funny, of course, in the Washingtonian context. If you ask them, are you going to make a coup? They would say 50-50. Right?
Oh, nice joke.
But what does 50-50 mean? Right? Probably.
Nice joke, yourself. We got about 7 minutes.
I didn't know I made a joke.
You'll explain it later.
No, I know, but I was kidding.
7 minutes to go. Anybody else? Ali Aslan, and then a friend from the VOA. Anybody else? Just three questions, and then I think we're going to wrap up. Go ahead, Ali Aslan.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The United States has given confusing signals after the military memo. First they said they are not party to this, and then they shift their position a little bit towards more pro-democracy position. What do you think would be the impact, or what impact to the understanding of the military? Is U.S. position relevant, really? Does U.S. public positions especially have any relevance or leverage for the Turkish military?
You know, this is a great question, first of all. I'll explain why even much bigger than, I don't know, but we have a fixation with the, in Turkey, with the American reaction. I think it's a hugely overblown fixation. I don't understand where I'm traveling the other countries to. No one has, is it to this degree? One really has to sit down and study why we have it this big. I have some idea. I'm taking even notes. One day I would like to write a political novel, a small one, and call it Washington Dumejisi, in fact, you know? They always say that someone pushes the button in Washington. I would like to kind of, as a ghost travel, maybe I can get the novel. Now I can get inspired. But seriously, one has to explain the internal dynamics of why we have the fixation. This doesn't mean that, of course, it's irrelevant, the U.S. reaction to it. But first of all, in this last one, if someone had asked me, look, in a comparative manner, what's the difference with this coup attempt? I would tell, the first thing came to my mind, I'm not 100% sure now, but I said, gosh, I said, this time, it's the first time Turkish army went against every kind of external wind and influence. They went against the economy, piazza, you know, that kind of thing, markets. What would markets say? They didn't appear to care about that. They didn't appear to care about the European whatever thing. They didn't appear to care about what U.S. would say, because there is all that understanding in Turkey that U.S. technically supports AK Parti type of government because of also U.S. agenda in Middle East and all that. Why not? Despite it, it looked like Turkish military went against all kinds of external stimulus, which tells me that either this time they went crazy, they didn't care about it, or these things were never that important at all.
Or there was a back channel.
Or there was a back channel. So that's the third thing that we don't know, but maybe they really communicated. But here is what one of, I have a graduate student, an American student, in fact, who's writing a master's, he's about to finish, and he's writing it on anti-Americanism in Turkey. He went and talked to even the soldiers. He's trying to really understand. I think he's going to write the Foreign Service exam, so... and then, this is interesting because when I read the thesis, he did all kinds of interviews. One thing we realized that the American image now in Turkey, and this thing did not help, this confusing reaction, is, you know, there's no principle at all. This country always goes pragmatic. Always goes pragmatic, which is a sad thing. My wife is American. She's from Vermont. And I always believed that there were always extreme values in this country, and I still believe in, that helped the world to be a better place. But this time, if I had told my students this way, no one would believe in me. They all think that it's extremely pragmatic and extremely profit-driven, like interest-driven, kind of wishy-washy country. So in that sense, I think that was an impact of that confusing effect. But I have to say something else that might even confuse you even further. But later on, this seeming race between the Turkish state and the governing party, almost to get a better response from the U.S., tells me that either there is really a powerful connection, or we have such a dogmatic understanding that our politicians and the statesmen are dying to get a positive word from the Washingtonian circles, which is tragic and shameful and embarrassing, if you ask me. Because I don't know what it has got to do with it, but I hope it doesn't have anything to do with some type of inferiority complex that you brought up. It wasn't my word. But see, it's a sad one. I don't know why we have this fixation. It's
first, Hilal, and now he is picking up on my private conversation. What I said was, and I won't deny it, has been kicked back to me, is
that, you know, this exaggerated notion of what America, whichever way it goes, is going to do, is going to determine the effect of Turkey, has to be explained in one form or another. And, you know, frankly, one explanation is as good as another. Please.
Well, you already mentioned the once existing consensus between the military and the government. I'll just focus on a recent development. The government has removed the deputy coordinator, actually, the...
Edip Paşa.
Recently from his office. I was just wondering if this is an indication of the end of the consensus and how much the possibility of a cross-border operation really affects the relationship.
I don't know much, actually. Whether I don't think there is a strong connection between his case and this breaking down of this general consensus between.
He happens to be a former general.
Yes, but one thing that, I mean, this is a separate issue, but maybe we should mention, this coordinatorship mechanism, very few people in Turkey had any, I don't know, positive understanding of this at all. When you, I mean, in conversations within the state structure, even a year ago, I remember I was in one of them, people were looking at it as if this was a mechanism, particularly the security establishment was extremely wary of it. They were thinking that this was a mechanism that Americans basically could comfortably postpone all kinds of demands, but there was another attachment to it. They were also thinking that the government also liked it very much because this postponement was very much mutual and avoidance. The government wanted to avoid all kinds of things, and Americans wanted to avoid all kinds of things too. They came up with this coordinatorship thing. Therefore, they could tell, I don't know, the others, look, wait, we need to wait and see. And there was a perfect also kind of name for it, Edip Paşa, who could have become even the chief of staff, was a classmate of the chief of staff, today's chief of staff. So it was a perfect, almost like a plan. You know, that was the understanding. I think his departure has different reasons. One, I think it became really obvious to him that he was being used now. His name was at, you know, kind of the stake in here. The other thing, he realized that, again, there was nothing that he could do. And then the army wasn't anymore at all backing him, even though they had kind of connections. And apparently there was some also personal, some problem. But I wouldn't interpret it as if it's much more related to the possibility of Turkish intervention in northern Iraq and all that. There are apparently all kinds of other... He was going to resign, and I don't think the government wanted him to resign. You know, and possibly also, the government wanted to add to the image that they are trying to give, that, see, you know, we're like Özal, we can't even fire generals.
Yeah, well, you know what? He had said one day before that he was going to leave the post, and so the government forcing
it preempted
him out of his position was less emphatic than it was in other words.
How do you see the extent of disagreement over a cross-border operation between the government and the military?
I think it's just answered that. He said he didn't think that it would...
Not with his case, but I think he's asking it as a separate, as an independent question. If you remember in my presentation, I wanted to say one thing, that this government's this seeming reluctance with respect to the Kurdish separatist issue and the northern Iraq thing has always been a problematic between, you know, the army and it. And that was one of the reasons that always that mistrust was there. I never knew. I can't comment on that. But there are, of course, all kinds of other reasons that you are, I'm sure, very familiar with. That one thing that type Erdogan never wanted was a further securitization within the country. Why? Now civilians learned it. If there is more securitization, there is a larger role for the state, security establishment, the army, that narrows down the political realm that the politics take place, and therefore smaller role for the politicians. And they know that. So they don't want further terrorism. They don't want further funerals. They don't want anything else because they know that it's a lose-lose situation for them because the state becomes more relevant, the army becomes more relevant, and MHP becomes more relevant. And politically, MHP wins, nationalists, and strategically, the state wins. So it's never good for them. But what is said with respect to Turkish foreign policy and all that, Turkey never appeared one single unitary actor in this issue, and I am sure all the other countries, including European Union, United States, they always, and including Barzani now, they always wanted to cash on it. That's a tragic thing for a country like Turkey that doesn't appear to be a single, you know, led by a single kind of cohesive governance body. That's pretty bad.
We don't have time to go into it, but of course if there's a war, there's the very real possibility, which is being discussed in Turkey, that the elections might be put off. But that's another whole area of discussion we can't get into. Final question will be from Roger Bavaller.
Part of my question was answered because Ali asked me almost the same question. I was going to ask his second part to it, or in comparison with the EU reaction to the 2017 e-statement, how we assess it. It's kind of a redundant question because you already mentioned in your suggestions or recommendations to the outside powers. You characterize that the EU approach is not quite helpful at all over the course of the events of the disease. How do you see that part of that comparison? Is it, was it this time helpful at all? And one just small comment. You made a tie between telling EU support to the support by the Turkish people actually was behind one of the driving forces of army's statement. Just for the public support of the EU process, I want to make this comment that it's not very much true, because if all the polls and opinion polls, when you characterize a question in such a format that you can get always this answer you want. Because if you touch upon the sensitivities like the Cyprus issue, or if you ask the ordinary people whether they would like to open their ports to Great Cyprus ships, then you will get an answer no. This doesn't mean that EU support is colored down in Turkish public opinion. Of course, there will be a follow because it was the case for all the candidate members, but there is a huge support in Turkish public opinion towards the EU.
No, you are right for the last part, but I think here is what the situation is. This is kind of my take. And I'll start with your comment and then get into the European reaction thing. There are European sources that there are Europeans are concerned that the support for Europe is in decline in Turkey. I mean, it's not the Turkish sources. That there is a genuine concern that Turkey now, Turks, are questioning, not the goal, but are questioning seriously the European intentions. See, it's not a support, it's a disappointment level. But it reflects itself in the support at the end of the day. If I think you don't like me, why should I kill myself to have you like me? If I think that you will never like me. I mean, there are details to it. It's that type of, I think, shrinking in the support because it's based on self-realization, kind of like whatever we do. Now the Sarkozy is talking. I mean, what would you do? Now we were hoping that he would change because he has the crown now. No, he's not. What would you do if you were the Turk? You start thinking that no, my hope is shrinking. Yeah, and therefore my support. Now they're saying my hope is shrinking. Maybe they're not saying therefore my support, but that's coming. That's what I mean. The European reaction is not helpful, of course. Why? It's linked to what I just said. It appears opportunist. It appears case-specific. It appears also like this ghost part of the ghost politics that I was referring to. Oh, see, I knew that they couldn't do it. A lot of people in Turkey are making this argument. They're saying that Europe has been shocked by our performance. Right? We think that way, has been shocked. They never thought we would go this much, which is probably true. And now the Europeans are saying, thanks God, we were right. For a sec, we thought that we were really wrong, that they had natural limitations. These Turks were really changing fast, but now they're going back to their origins. So, and that's why the reaction is not really helpful. And also, what European reaction? You listen to the British one, you listen to the Finnish one, you listen to the representative in Ankara. That's why I don't even study European politics anymore. It's not cohesive. No, seriously, at least U.S., you know, is just a little more consistent. You know, which United States has a fewer number answer than which Europe?
Yeah.
So that's how I'm sorry.
Tunjai Bawala just moved from London, the embassy in London, to the embassy in Washington.
I didn't know that.
That might have explained why he was interested in the European reaction. Anyway, we're 10 minutes over time. I apologize to everyone who wanted to leave at 3:30. I'd like to thank our speaker, Dr. Aydınlı. Thank you very much for a very stimulating talk.